Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
Well, so there were some, I made a little list of some themes that I read about as I was reading the book. I wrote about mother guilt. You talked about that a lot. You talked about feeling guilty, I guess, for feeling bad about his diagnosis.
Yes.
Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You talked about feeling inadequate. You talked about exhaustion. You talked a lot about kind of God's hand in our lives in general, but in that, in the fact that you had a child that has Down syndrome. Was that, did God want that for you? I mean, I think that's sort of part of Mormon theology, the idea that God is very involved and that if we have a challenge, it's for us to learn a specific thing, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yep.
I'm the primary chorister in my ward, and I was telling the kids on Sunday that we were having a lesson about the Holy Ghost, and we do the music in our ward very much, like, together, so we don't have singing time and sharing time. So I just stood up to do a part of this one song, and I said, I want to tell you guys this story about a time that I felt the Holy Ghost. And that wasn't planned. I looked at the primary presidency. I was like, is this good? And she was like, oh, yeah, that's great. So I said, I'm just going to be totally honest with you guys and tell you that I've never had an experience where I felt like there was a voice that told me, like, don't go there, or, turn around. None of these safety stories. I said, I'm almost 37 years old, and I've never had that experience. I've heard other people tell, and 10 years or so ago, I may have felt kind of bad, kind of like, well, why did these other people have these amazing stories where, they get saved from a terrible train wreck or whatever? I've just never had that. So I told the primary kids that, and some of the teachers were laughing just like you are, but this is part of my, like, I'm totally honest.
Yeah.
And I said, and I have not really had very many experiences either where I would have felt awash with any sort of big confirmation or where I just really felt like this is right. I just haven't. And I said, I'm just going to tell you guys about one time, though, when I really felt like I was comforted, and I call this, the Holy Ghost. So I was telling them that probably 7 or 8 years ago, my brother got married. We all were there. He and his wife got married in the Seattle Temple. My parents were so happy because all of us were there. We were there in the celestial room together. It was a neat moment for our family. And then we left, and they went to go to the reception, and we took a bunch of pictures, and then we were going to follow them. And my parents got in a terrible car wreck. A Frito-Lay truck swerved over into their lane, and my parents and my sister, they were all in the van. They had to come get the jaws of life and, like, cut open the door, and my sister's baby was, like, half hanging upside down in his car seat.
Oh, my gosh.
It was terrible. So they took every – and we were in the car behind them, so we saw it all. They took everybody in multiple ambulances, and I was, like, calling my brother, who was halfway to Canada, saying, oh, my gosh, we're not going to come. Everybody's in the emergency room. It was terrible. So I was just saying
– oh, my gosh.
It started out as, like, this great family day, turned to terrible in a big hurry, and then – I was there with my dad, and someone came in, the doctor came in and said, Mr. Olson, are you aware that you have a golf ball sized tumor in your brain? And my dad said, no. And my dad has had two other kinds of cancer, and he had his arm amputated, actually. So the doctor asked, is that a war wound or whatever? He said, no, it's from cancer, but it's probably from 20 years ago. And so the doctor said, okay, well, then it's not related. This is something totally new. And I was there. I don't know. It was 7 or 8 years ago, but I remember thinking, this needs to be one of my sisters in here. This needs to be my mom in here. But they were all off somewhere else. And I was very upset. I mean, anyway, everybody flew home. He had surgery. And I was mad and sad. I was mad at God. And one of my sisters actually told my dad, hey, Heather said that she's mad at God. And so my dad sat me down and said, I don't want you ever to think that because I'm not mad at all. I don't have one bit of anger. I just feel like I've had so many blessings, so I felt kind of humbled by that. But I was just telling the primary kids that for a couple months, it was very hard for me to just even go to work. I felt like I could just cry at any moment. I'd be up teaching my students, like, the preterite versus the imperfect in my high school Spanish class or whatever, and I would just start to cry,
Yeah.
And I said, one morning I was reading out of this little book. It was one of these little devotional books of quotes by President Hinckley. Mm-hmm. The story is totally turning long. I need an editor. Anyway, so I read, maybe John will do that for us. I read this quote. I don't even remember what it was, and I just felt this totally overwhelming sense, like everything's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I said, and I didn't feel like this is going to go away. I did not have any thought that, like, my dad was just going to get well and this wasn't going to be an issue anymore. And that has, you know, not been the case. He's still alive, but it's still sort of there, just lurking around, doing its nasty little thing. But I said, and I felt like that was the spirit. I felt like I'm still very sad. I don't understand this, but I just felt like everything's going to be okay. And I told that to the kids. And then one little girl who's probably 7, I guess, said, see, everything's for a reason. When she said that, I was kind of thinking, wow, that was totally not the message I was trying to give you. But like, okay, because then, and I didn't, I just said, okay. But afterwards I thought, well, what did she mean by that? Because that almost implies that, like, the reason that we had that experience and my dad still has a brain tumor is so that I would learn, like, so that I could experience that manifestation of the Holy Ghost. And then I was thinking, I'm not really down with that. I mean, that little girl can think whatever she wants, but I just wouldn't want to say, well, yeah, well, that was worth it. I mean, I could have done without that experience. And if I had to choose, I would say, yeah, I didn't need that. And we'll give the brain tumor back and the car wreck and all that. Like, we didn't really need that experience. But I thought it was interesting that a girl that young said that. See, everything's for a reason. Because I'm like, wow, is everything for a reason? I'm like, I don't know. Or does bad stuff just happen, you know? I don't know. But you touched on that issue, feeling like, did God want me to have this experience? Did God choose me to have this experience? I don't know if you want to talk about that for a minute or not.
Oh, sure. That's actually kind of at the root of kind of the spiritual change that I've experienced since Thomas's birth. I used to very much believe in a micromanaging kind of God, you know, very benevolent, of course, but a God who was a puppet master of sorts, mm-hmm. who was all day long, you know, pulling strings one way or another for things to happen a certain way so that other things could happen a certain way. Just being behind all of this cause and effect. And it was a very comforting paradigm because anything that happened in my life, I could say, well, this is what God wanted. And God knows this is best for me. Mm-hmm. And so I don't need to be afraid because, you know, God's in charge and he thought this was a good idea, so I can have faith and relax. But that all kind of went out the window when Thomas was born. When he was born, I still believed kind of the folk doctrine that God handpicks which of his spirit children will be born with disabilities and picks specific families for them to be born into. Okay. And that this is all orchestrated and arranged for the greater good of everyone involved. And that just did not jive with me anymore. As I went through that first year with Thomas, that idea that I believe is very comforting, in our culture because disability is a very difficult reality, and that philosophy is a way of coming to terms with a difficult reality and kind of framing it in a positive way and takes away a lot of the uneasiness and the unanswered questions and the ambiguity. And so we love philosophies like that. We love folk doctrines like that, and we have a whole ton of them in the church. But I could not abide by it anymore. I came to know so many families that were extraordinary in many ways, but it was so clear that what was, you know, quote, special about them was a result of their experiences and not a cause. Mm-hmm. In other words, these moms didn't have children with Down syndrome sent to them because they're special. Many of them do seem quite special in many ways, but that is because they've opened themselves up to the experience that has come their way and allowed themselves to be changed in a positive manner by this difficult thing. I do not believe for one second that God is up there sending disabled babies to families that he's picked because they have some sort of special capacity to love a disabled child mm-hmm. or to care for a disabled child. In fact, frankly, I find that idea offensive personally, although I don't get mad at people who believe it and I don't make a fuss about it. But to me, it's a very ignorant idea because of the hundreds of thousands and possibly millions of babies who have been born with disabilities into conditions that were anything but special.
Right.
Born abandoned by families, institutionalized, the conditions that disabled individuals have lived in have been atrocious. And I think it's awful to claim that God arranged this baby to go to this family because this family is so special for some reason. It just does not add up for me. The current abortion rate for fetuses of Down syndrome is astronomical. It's estimated to be about 90%.
Yes.
Oof. And I can't... Whenever someone says to me, well, special babies come to special parents, I want to quote that statistic, not in condemnation of the mothers who have chosen abortion, because although I have plenty of strong feelings about that, that's not my point. But rather to say, are you really so confident that all of these parents who find out that they are pregnant with a baby with Down syndrome, can you really be so confident that they are all been handpicked by God and that they are all special and somehow qualified mm-hmm. beyond a typical human being for the job? Mm-hmm. I think it's just kind of a ludicrous idea. Mm-hmm. But I understand why people repeat it and why people believe it. And it's something that I believed myself until I had a personal experience, which gave me reason to believe otherwise. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, strong feelings about it, but I understand why others have that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
As far as how that, did you want me to relate that in a more general sense to like how my view of God changed?
Sure.
That God that was such a comforting and familiar God to me for so long just became a concept that just did not fit with my life experience anymore. And my idea of God has changed quite a bit. I believe firmly that God intervenes when absolutely necessary. I mean, the scriptures are full of stories of God intervening in people's lives. I believe that there are interventions that come for a number of reasons, and I've seen interventions in my own life. But generally speaking, I believe that God has prepared an environment for us to come and live in that does the teaching pretty much automatically. You don't need God to lightning bolt you with an experience to teach you about patience. Just mm-hmm. go live your life and you will get all the lessons that you need about patience. Okay. And same with everything else. Loving people, having faith, forgiveness. I mean, any important tenet that you could pick out, mm-hmm. life and relationships are the laboratories for learning those things, and it happens spontaneously. It happens organically. Mm-hmm. God does not need to set up a series of specific experiences for a specific individual in order for them to learn and grow in the ways that they need. Mm-hmm. I just think that there are so many paths to becoming who you want and need to be, and if you make a decision that sets your life in a certain direction. I'm not a fan of the whole idea that you can ruin your whole life with one choice. You know, they talk about the train track stories that, you know, if the train, there's a metaphor about the train being switched.
My husband hates that story.
Yeah. I used to love that, because I used to think, yes, there is one path, like, foreordained and predetermined for me, and all I need to do is pray hard enough to figure out what choices to make that will keep me on that path, and I will make it. And I don't believe that at all anymore. I believe that there is a whole wide open realm of possibility, and not that God is not aware or concerned or involved in our lives, but that he doesn't need to micromanage what happens to us on a personal level. We will spontaneously learn what we need to learn just by virtue of being here for the most part.
Okay.
That's something that I gained. That's an insight that I gained from all these parents of kids with Down syndrome.
Okay. Interesting. That is, well, I've had a hard time talking about that issue with my kids as my kids have gotten older, and my kids, they just ask me questions, and lots of times I just feel like, I can't answer this, you know? But my oldest daughter came home probably about 6 months ago and said that they had had this lesson in Young Women about fasting. And so she asked me something like, well, what do you think about that? Or I don't see you doing that, and I don't intentionally not do it, but lots of times I just forget. And so I just, again, in the spirit of honesty, I said, you know what? I think it's a good idea. And I said, but I've never had an experience, any kind of spiritual experience, while I was fasting. And so I know other people do. I said, I just haven't. I don't know why, but I also don't think anymore, oh, it's because I needed to do it more, or I needed to do it harder or differently or whatever. I just was saying I just haven't really had an experience with that. And then she said, well, remember that one time when Bapa, that's what they call my dad, remember that one time when he had that brain tumor? And I was sort of listening to her thinking, the brain tumor that he still has? Yes, I remember. And she said, well, and everybody fasted, and then he went into the hospital and they did surgery, and now he's okay.
Ooh.
Yes. And I said, well, he still has it. They took out what they could of it, and they did radiation, and they did chemotherapy. It's still kind of there. And then I was feeling kind of bad because we don't talk about it that much, because it's just, it's just there, you know, so we just don't need to talk about it. But I was more worried about her saying, just in such a neat, tidy way, and remember we all fasted about it, and she probably didn't. I mean, she was little, but we talked about it. She knew that the adults were doing it on a particular Sunday, or for many Sundays, actually, for her to just come to that conclusion. And I said, well, honey, I just don't really know. I wouldn't probably say that. She said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, what about the people like that were maybe in the hospital room to the right of him and to the left of him? And those people probably also had people praying for them and maybe fasting for them. We don't know. And they died, you know?
Yeah.
I said, so what do you do about that? And then my kids sort of, then I was feeling like a major buzzkill, you know, or a testimony killer.
Way to go, Mom.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, I felt good doing it because all my family was doing it together and I felt like we were kind of united. And so it felt like I brought us together, but I didn't think it was like, you know, Harry Potter, like we did that and then now he's better. Cause then I was also thinking, well, at some point, you know, the outcome could be unfortunate. And then what's she going to think? Like that we didn't do it right, or we couldn't get God to make it be what, you know, to give us the outcome that we wanted, you know? And then my middle daughter interrupted and said, well, but Mom, well, I want to think that Heavenly Father helps us. And then I said, oh, I want to too. I said, I'm not trying to say that that doesn't ever happen, but it's just really a hard issue. I said, well, did he help Bapa and not somebody else? You know, I don't know. It's hard. So we talked about it a little bit, and afterwards I did feel kind of bad. I thought, well, should I have said something different? Should I have, I don't know. I don't know. It was a very hard issue for me to try to explain to my kids something that I really maybe don't understand either.
Yeah. I mean, that's a tough issue for, I think, for so many of us. And I've had similar conversations with my children, and you know, the best that I can offer them is that I have faith that good comes from prayer and fasting. How that good is manifest,
right,
we don't have any control over, and sometimes we don't even see it.
Right.
I do believe that I do believe that prayer works in the sense that it generates a positive influence. It brings more goodness into being as a result, and that's something that that I can get behind 100%. But as far as, you know, what's the specific consequence of a prayer? That's a whole different,
right.
a whole different story.
Yeah, that's a hard, well, it was a hard issue for me anyway. So you talk in the book also, I would say, about grief and about loss, but then it's sort of coupled with gain, and you talked about that a little bit with your gifts book, kind of that those are maybe two sides of the same coin, but I wondered if you, like, if you could talk a little bit about what you talked in there about grieving, and you talked about, I think, feeling like you had lost something.
Yes.
So what would you say, what were you grieving, or what do you feel like you had lost? You were mourning the loss of what?
Well, a number of things. The first and most obvious being that I was mourning the child that I expected to have, but that I didn't have.
Okay.
You know, the son that was born was a different individual than the son I was expecting. And so that's a really normal process for parents of kids with disabilities to go through, grieving the loss of the expected child. But beyond that, I was grieving the loss of a series of beliefs that had given me great comfort for a long period of time that had just kind of fallen apart. You know, one being that if I am determined enough, I can rise to any occasion. I can make things work. I can be who I want and need to be as long as I exercise my free will till its fullest. I will not be inadequate. I will not fail. I really believed that success hinged upon a person's degree of determination. And to see myself fall apart despite my own best intentions and efforts to not fall apart was really humbling. And I realized that there are circumstances in which you cannot triumph just because you want to. That as powerful as the human will is, you cannot will yourself through a difficult experience without experiencing pain. You can't use your willpower to change deep-seated emotions that spring from difficult experiences. You can't use your will to change other people and their reactions. That was a sincere loss because it was a very secure idea to believe that I was in control and that if I just worked hard enough, I could make things be the way I wanted them to be. And it was difficult to let that go. It was difficult to let go of the illusion that I would always be available for my children and give them what they need. That was a pretty dramatic time in my life where I was not able to give my children what they wanted and needed at that time. I was struggling too much myself to be the resource for them that I expected myself to be. And that was also a very humbling experience and a sense of loss when I realized I can't be for my kids who I thought I could be for them. I can't be, in effect, kind of their protector and almost their savior, you know, their the person who is going to shield them from the difficulties of life, at least the kind beyond the usual day-to-day ups and downs. These were all kind of fundamental beliefs that I had that I didn't even know that I had until they fell apart. And I didn't know what was going to replace them. You know, I didn't know what I was going to believe instead. And there is a great sense of emptiness and loss to see that certainty go away and not know what was going to come next.
Okay, so you would say one of the things that you lost was a sense of certainty about other beliefs. Lots of things.
Yeah.
Lots of things.
Certainty and control.
Control. Okay.
Certainty and control, yeah.
Okay.
A lot of that went out the window.
And would you say, you said that you felt empty and you wondered how you would replace or kind of plug in those holes. And would you say now that you have, or do you just live with that uncertainty, or do you feel like there's something, it's turned into something different?
That's a really good question. I think that I have begun to find different answers to these questions. I can't say that I have wrapped up, you know, all these tough issues and mastered them and got them in the bag, or anything even close. But it's been more of a kind of a surrender than it has been a rebuilding. It's been more of a letting go than a gathering and a holding.
Okay.
More of a sense of trusting. Trusting God, trusting the way things have been set up in a general sense for this life, instead of constantly railing against them, trusting that conditions here will help us all get to where we want and need to go. Just some really basic changes as far as what's most important.
Okay.
What's the purpose of being here? What am I working hard for? Mm-hmm. What do I want most? Those things have all changed a great deal. And yeah, I have a different focus in those areas than I used to.
That sounds like faith to me, what you're describing.
Yeah.
Trust.
Yeah, it is.
We have, I talked about this in the interview I did with John and a couple other people, where in the Friend magazine a month or so ago, it had across the top of the page, "We do not doubt." And I was sad when I saw that, although I know it's a kids magazine, but I kind of thought, well, that sort of demonizes the idea of doubt or of being uncertain, but I think probably most people deal just in their daily lives with some degree of certainty and doubt. Mm-hmm. So I sort of hate to see us act like that doesn't happen, because I think that's another one of those things that we don't like to talk about. If I say,
yes,
I'm not
yeah.
really sure about this thing that we, you know, this piece of Mormon theology, or I don't know what I think about this, that could really cause you, you know, some problems in like your ward family or just in your own family for people to admit
yes.
that.
Yeah, it's like a taboo kind
yes.
of thing.
But that's yeah. very real for me. That's one of those things where, you know, if I at church say, I don't know what I think about this, I find people flock to like say, oh, well, I've never heard anybody say that. And then I think, well, I can't mm-hmm. be the only person to ever have thought this, but apparently in your experience, I'm the only person who's ever been willing to like throw myself on my sword, you know? And I'm like, all I'm saying is I don't really know. That doesn't seem threatening, but somehow it is.
Yeah, it is within a paradigm where certainty is an indicator of righteousness and success, you
right.
know, and you admit, oh, I don't have that. And it's like, well, what's wrong with you then? Because
you need to pray
if you're
harder.
Doing, yeah, if you're doing everything you're supposed to do, you will have certainty.
Mm-hmm.
And that was similar to my experience with grief, where there's room for grief in Mormon culture, but only kind of within certain bounds and certain conditions, and there's a lot expected of us to not fall apart during very, very difficult times. There's a huge emphasis put on fortitude, stoicism,
right.
kind of pioneer style endurance, the idea that if you have sufficient faith, you will not experience excruciating emotional or spiritual pain. I felt that expectation really strongly, and that's why I was ashamed that I was having such a hard time, because mm-hmm. I thought that meant that I was somehow inferior.
Right.
Mm. And that, I think that's really unfortunate.
Yes.
In fact, just this morning I was saying to a friend, she was having a really difficult experience in a relationship she's having, and she was talking about all this pain she was having and how stupid she felt for having the pain.
Mm.
And I think that is just a theme that I hear over and over and over in Mormon circles, particularly amongst Mormon women.
Okay.
Which is, first, there's the layer of of direct experience, you know, something painful happens, something difficult happens, and there are all sorts of things to deal with as a result. Emotions to deal with, logistics and circumstances to deal with, hard things that you have to manage all of a sudden. And as if that layer weren't hard enough, so often we add an extra layer on top of that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like our feelings about our feelings. It's like this this meta level experience where we can't just be sad. We feel guilty that we're sad, or we feel sad that we're sad. Mm-hmm. We can't feel angry, just be angry, like, and have that just exist. There's always like a meta reaction to that emotion. Where we will question and sometimes reject and worry over how it is that we feel. And it makes things so much more complicated. If I could have just accepted my sorrow and disappointment and grief and anger and resentment about the difficult surprise of my son's diagnosis, if I could have let that be, I would have bounced back a whole lot sooner. But I was so ashamed that I was having those emotions that I it became kind of a vortex, kind of a downward spiral where I would feel something negative, and then I would punish myself for feeling negative in the first place, because good Mormons don't feel that way and good moms don't feel that way.
Okay.
And that would just make everything worse.
So you would say then that your Mormonism played into that?
Absolutely.
Or exacerbated it. Exacerbated the already hard feelings that you were dealing with.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And I've got some flack for saying so. I've had some people vigorously deny that there's this sort of expectation rampant in Mormon culture about how we handle tough situations. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really interesting, because as this one particular individual I have in mind, as she was repeating over and over to me that Mormons don't judge that way and Mormons don't criticize each other that way and expect such things of each other, that's exactly what she was doing to me in that very conversation.
Right.
And I tried to point that out, and that made her even more mad. But there's very much kind of a code of conduct that if you and it can vary from place to place. I'm not saying it's the same for every member of the church across the world. I'm talking about my own environment, my own sphere. And if you're going to react and behave differently than what's expected, that causes a lot of additional difficulty on top of the thing that's causing the struggle to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we do have sort of a particular focus on, well, like self-reliance, you know, emergency preparedness, like pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah.
You know, or if you're having a hard time, just pray harder and read your scriptures more, and then it'll either go away or you'll figure out how to deal with it. That I guess can be pretty unforgiving at times if we act on it, or if we fail to act when we should.
I do want to say that in terms of outreach to me after Thomas was born, my ward was extraordinary. And what I had, my neighbor across the street handed me the keys to her car and said, you know, take it, use it anytime to drive up to the hospital. We had people signed up for meals and help with rides and all kinds of things. And so there was not at all any sort of message to me that, you know, we don't want you to be struggling right now. It's bad that you're struggling. It didn't come from the people around me. Mm-hmm. It came from an expectation I had within myself that I think was absorbed over, you know, a greater period of time, and was not the result of feeling like people around me were shaming me at all.
Okay.
I was ashamed of myself.
Okay.
And that's, I thought, I wanted to be better than that. I wanted to be the person who could pick herself up by her bootstraps and be just fine.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, so yeah, I did want to ask you about that because you talk in there about people calling you, people coming over. You talk too, well, I don't want to give too much away, but you talk about, I would say, lots of people really being helpful, but about the fact that you, at times, were annoyed by their efforts. Is that a fair characterization, or you wanted them to go away?
Yeah. I had an intense desire for privacy.
Okay.
During that time, which I think is a pretty normal thing, you know, for at least people with certain personality types, where when you are, it's kind of like when you're in labor and you're in terrible pain and you curl up in a ball.
Yes.
Because you're just trying to deal.
Right.
With this, and you don't want visitors. You don't want to talk to people. You don't want anyone to see the hospital bed where, you know, you might have just lost bladder control. You know, you don't want to be on display
right. When
you are in agony.
Okay.
It's a very raw experience, and you don't want spectators, as well-intentioned as they may be. So a complex situation there
right. Where
I needed and wanted help. I mean, if everyone had ignored me, then I would have been crushed. You know, I needed and appreciated knowing that people cared. But
okay.
I think sometimes one of the most charitable things we can offer someone is a willingness to be there for them, but also a willingness to step back and give them the space they need according to their wishes.
Okay.
There's kind of the parenting technique of stay close enough so that your teenagers can push you away. That's what we do in our most safe, love-filled relationships, is there are people close enough to us that we can push away at times. And I'm really grateful for my friends and neighbors and ward members who stuck around and continued to express their concern and their support even though I was being very antisocial. I think that was incredibly Christ-like behavior, and it's exactly what I needed. And I hope that I can offer the same to others, just ongoing support, but also respectful of space and privacy.
Okay, Kathy, so talk to us maybe in broad strokes about how, kind of looking back, not that this experience is like over for you by any stretch of the imagination, but how you would say that it has been good for your family, or how it's strengthened you, and how it's been difficult, maybe, both of those things.
Okay, yeah, well, that's actually, I love the question, first of all, because, you know, we've talked a lot about how there's always like these two contradicting truths that you're trying to find your way, trying to find your balance in between, like with your kids, praising them versus teaching them that what they do for praise is not what makes them a valuable person.
Mm-hmm.
There's a similar kind of dichotomy here where sometimes people feel like they need to either frame disability and Down syndrome in particular as a blessing or a hardship and or a tragedy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's either fundamentally really good or it's fundamentally really sad and bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with this is that both are true.
Okay.
It's not either or. There are elements of Thomas's condition that have led to amazing blessings for me and for my family. Things that I would not trade for, you know, I would not give up. But it's important for people to remember that all of these things come at a price. You know, there's, for every valuable insight that you glean, you've paid a price for that. You've, through your own experience. And it's important to not sweep that difficulty under the rug and pretend like it's not there and that it's just all rainbows and puppies at every house where there's a kid with Down syndrome. That's just not fair.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not right. So, again, back to our house. Just this morning, Ben was, my son Ben, he's 15 and a half. He was babysitting Thomas while I took two of my younger kids to swimming lessons. And when I got back, he was just, he was grinning from ear to ear because Thomas kissed him on the cheek, which is something that he doesn't spontaneously kiss us. You know, that's just not really his style. But apparently he was lying on my bed with Ben. They were playing with toys on my bed, and he just kind of crawled over to him and climbed up on his chest and kissed him on the cheek. And Ben was just beaming. It was just so the cutest, cutest thing. And the kids, all the kids, just treasure their connections with Thomas. They all have kind of a soft spot in their hearts for him, and they all make efforts to interact with him and feel really gratified when he responds to them. It can be difficult because Thomas doesn't speak at all. He doesn't have any verbal capacity as far as words go. He's never said mama. He's never said anything. And so we can't talk to him. Not only does he not speak aloud, but he also doesn't have receptive language ability. So if you say, you know, Thomas, where's your nose? You know, point to your nose. He has no idea what you're saying. And so the typical means of communication in a family, you know, talking and listening, aren't options for us. But that has actually enabled all of us, I think, to learn something that otherwise we couldn't have learned, which is the power of nonverbal communication and just how effectively you can connect with somebody and communicate with somebody wordlessly. And I see that's really transformed my perspective, my perception in all of my relationships. And I know for my children as well, they really want him to talk. In fact, my son Andrew, who's 13, particularly is anxious for Thomas to talk. And he'll ask me every few weeks or so, Mom, when do you think Thomas is going to talk? Do you think he'll ever talk? I really want him to talk. I really want to be able to talk to him. You know, I want to be able to talk to him. And I totally understand that. I just, you know, I'd give anything to have him look at me and say, Mommy! And I have dreams about him talking.
Wow.
I have kind of recurring dreams in which he's talking, and in the dream I'm just elated, and I think, you know, it finally happened. It's finally true, and he's actually talking. And then I wake up, and I'm like, okay, that was just a dream. But despite that desire to talk to him, and to listen to him, the bond is strong. The bond is strong for all of us.
So, do you anticipate that he will be able to speak or not?
You know, we really don't know.
Okay.
There's just no way of knowing. He's got a hearing disorder on top of everything else. He has what's called a central auditory dysfunction, which you might remember reading about in the memoir.
Yes.
And we still don't know how that may be affecting his language development. All we know is that his brain waves in response to sound are abnormally shaped. And we don't know, the doctors theorize that it's possible that that distorts sound for him, that, you know, when he hears us talking, it's coming through in a staticky way or a garbled or an under, just a way that makes perception of individual words very difficult, if not impossible. That's one theory, but we don't know.
Okay.
And we'll just have to see how things go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do you, you talked then about some things that, how it's, good things that have come about in terms of your family relationships. Is there anything unique that you would say that has influenced, my gosh, I can't even talk, your marriage?
Yes. I think at the most basic level, having Thomas has created a bond between my husband and I that wasn't there previously, simply because we know that we're the only two adults on the planet who see him the way that we can see him. And that's, you know, that's true for all of our kids. I think that most married couples, part of what bonds them together is their mutual appreciation for their children in a way that adults who are not those children's parents can't have. Mm-hmm. You know, you and your husband are the only people on earth who love your kids the way you love your kids. Mm. But there's something, a little something extra regarding Thomas along those lines. I think because when he was born that first year, there were so many complex emotions, so many considerations that we had never faced before, and working through those together really opened communication between the two of us on another level. We were both vulnerable and shaken in a way that we hadn't been before. And so that vulnerability, that mutual vulnerability, can kind of make or break a relationship. You know, it can, the stress, the strain, the challenges can either draw you closer together eventually, you know, bit by bit, or they can really put a wedge between you. Mm-hmm. And we're lucky in that the two of us have had very similar feelings about and responses to Thomas's diagnosis from the start. Okay. And so the overall experience has been really positive for us.
Okay.
It's not always that way. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine just how wrenching it would be if he and I were not on the same page about this child.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I go and visit parents of newborn babies with Down syndrome in our area from time to time. And I visited a family last month, and the mom was holding the baby, just this gorgeous, gorgeous little baby that I was dying to hold, but I couldn't because she was medically, you know, vulnerable to germs, so I couldn't hold her. I was dying to. And the mom was trying so hard to hold it together and to be strong for her kids and to accept her daughter the way she's come. But her husband, unfortunately, thought it would be best to give the baby up for adoption. He didn't think that their family was a good place for this baby to grow up. And this is not a condemnation of the husband, because I believe that in some circumstances, that could be the case. In some circumstances, a baby with Down syndrome might be better off in another household. And there's actually a long waiting list of families that want to adopt a child with Down syndrome. The problem in this situation isn't his perspective or her perspective, but just the difference between the two.
Wow.
And when you've got one spouse who's heading in one direction and one spouse heading in the other, you know, I walked away wondering how they were ever going to work this through. And no matter which way they went, no matter what decision they made, it was going to be a difficult kind of sticking point between them probably for a very long time.
Oof.
And so I think I don't want to perpetuate scare tactics, which are sometimes perpetuated by people who say, okay, you shouldn't have a baby with Down syndrome. You know, you should have an abortion because this strain will ruin your marriage. And that's something that people take very seriously, and that is a message that's given to parents when there's a Down syndrome pregnancy. I don't think that is a helpful bias to burden a couple with from the start.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as with everything, it's really important to acknowledge the possibilities on both ends
mm-hmm.
of the spectrum that, yeah, this will likely cause stress in your family. It will cause some challenges. It could be very difficult in some ways. And it's important to acknowledge that those things are all true. But it's equally important to acknowledge the flip side. And no one seems to want to acknowledge both at once. There's kind of two camps. And the proponents are just constantly cheerleading what's so wonderful. And the opponents are constantly harping on how awful it is. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of drives me crazy because they're both true. You know, they're both accurate. And the tug of war just doesn't do anybody any good.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So if someone, like if you could give some advice, I guess, if someone wanted to feel like they were doing the right thing, or to be supportive of someone, if they had a friend or a family member that had a child with Down syndrome, what would you suggest that they do or not do?
I think the most helpful thing that a person can do is to avoid making assumptions about how the parents are feeling. The most treasured interactions I had after Thomas was born happened with two friends of mine separately, and they both approached me in a similar way, in a way that acknowledged kind of the mixed bag of the situation, and that meant a tremendous amount to me. I had one friend call and say, you know, I heard about Thomas's diagnosis, you know, that's such a big piece of news, and I've been wondering how you're feeling, and if you're feeling sad, I want to cry with you. And if you're feeling glad, I want to be happy with you. And I just don't know how you're feeling. So please tell me, how is it? How are you feeling? And that was just amazing. That was the perfect, for me, the perfect approach. Because the people who came to me with big smiles and hearts and balloons, like, rah, 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 you're so lucky, that really triggered my sadness and disappointment and anger about the situation. And conversely, the people who had real long faces and just shaking their heads and, oh, what a shame, that really triggered my pride and my joy and my gratitude for having this child. Again, both of those opposites are true at once. So if you're leaning too far to one side or the other, it kind of triggers the opposite reaction. And I believe that the most helpful approach is one that's focused on not what the parent should be feeling, but what they're actually feeling.
Okay. All right. Good. That's great advice. All right. So let's have one more question, Kathy, because I guess after all, this is Mormon stories, right? So
that's right.
If you could talk about how this experience has changed in good ways or in bad ways, your testimony or your feelings about the church.
I would say that my testimony has changed tremendously over the past almost 5 years. The solid core of my testimony, my fundamental tenets of faith, especially regarding Jesus Christ, the atonement, have become even stronger, have deepened, and have become even more important to me. The peripheral aspects of my testimony, kind of the things that you kind of add on top of the basic truths, a lot of those have changed very, very dramatically. There are things I used to believe that I no longer believe. You know, we've talked about some of those. There are times that I feel like I am kind of alone in a crowd at church because most of the people around me still subscribe to a certain worldview that I don't have anymore. And it can be kind of lonely to be sitting there and having everyone talking about in platitudes and talking about these tidy equations that describe how things work in life. And you're sitting there just knowing that that's not how it's been for you. And you can raise your hand and share your experience. But it can still be hard sometimes to feel like you're the only one who sees it that way. You know, you long for validation. And so in that respect, my online friends have been a huge support to me. It's been an enormous boost to my level of church activity to be able to connect with people who otherwise I would not be able to talk to and connect with because of geography. So, like, my participation on the blogs with Segula, with By Common Consent, with individual relationships I have with people have all been a tremendous help to me and enabled me to kind of make it through the difficult transition period of feeling pretty alone. And these days, that's becoming less and less of an issue because I'm feeling more and more settled within myself and more confident about who I am and what I believe at this point in time. And I don't have the same kind of insecurity about being different. And that's a really positive change for me. Mm-hmm. My testimony of the Savior has really deepened and evolved. And likewise, my perception of my relationship with God the Father has also changed quite a bit. I sense our interactions with each other differently than I used to, and I pray differently, and I hope for different things, and I don't know how to say it in a succinct way. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it's the experience as a whole completely shredded my testimony in a way, but also made it rock solid at the same time. It's mm-hmm. like it got rid of a lot of extraneous material. Mm-hmm. It shook me so hard that anything that wasn't completely solid just fell off. You know, mm-hmm. it couldn't withstand the stress of the situation. And the parts that remained are even more sturdy than before it all started.
Okay. Do you have any other final thoughts or, I wish I said this or I should have said this?
Maybe probably the final thing that I would say is that the situation with Thomas has very much opened my eyes to the reality that we're all here to learn the same things, that we're all in the same boat. You know, the entire human family is in the same boat with the same struggles and challenges. And we have those challenges. They come in different packages. You know, they come in different situations and circumstances. But all of us are here to learn how to love God, love ourselves, and love other people. And as I've talked about kind of rejecting the idea that God sent Thomas to me because I was a special mom who was uniquely qualified to love him, which I can promise you is not the case. Kind of the flip side of that is, especially in LDS culture, is, well, okay, if he didn't send Thomas to you because you were so well-suited to be his mom, then maybe he sent Thomas to you because you needed so badly to learn what Thomas could teach you. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, because you have struggled so much with the issue of disability, that's exactly why God gave you Thomas. And I can accept that to a certain extent. I can certainly acknowledge that I've been changed in so many fundamental and vital ways through my relationship with him that I'm extremely grateful for and that I count it as a tremendous blessing. But I think it's a mistake to frame little babies with disability coming down to earth as, well, they're going to the parents who need to learn about love. Mm-hmm. Because every single parent does.
Right.
I don't think that I'm any more suited to loving Thomas or any less suited to loving him than any other person walking the streets of South Jordan, Utah at this moment. You know, I'm not a standout in either direction. And I feel really strongly that we not categorize each other in these ways and think, oh, well, that happened to her because she needs to learn about this or that. is there any one of us who doesn't need to learn the things that I'm learning through my relationship with Thomas? I mean,
right.
Is there any one of us who would not benefit from that kind of experience, that kind of life-changing experience? Mm-hmm. And all of us will have our own version of, you know, the unhappy surprise and the dashed expectations. All of us will be in situations where we have to confront our preconceived notions and our biases. You know, the whole point of life, it spontaneously brings us to stare ourselves in the face and confront what's ungodly and unhappy about ourselves. That's mm-hmm. just how it works. It's how it's designed to work. And I just want people to, I guess I want everyone to not only look at Thomas as if he's a human being just like their kids, but I hope that others will look at me the same way and not see me as some sort of greater than or less than or in any ways set apart from themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not any different from you or anybody else. And we all have a deep need to have our hearts broken and transformed and sanctified, and all of us do. That's all I want to say.
Okay. I think we should end it on that, because I feel like I'll ruin it if I say anything else.
Okay.
Okay, let's call it.
All right.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.